Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, March 31st, 2022, continuing where I left off last week. What we were talking about, I was going through the 300-page book and all of the scientific discoveries that came out of my work while I was at that two-year period, what I call the Cornell years. And where I left off is I had described the situation with the sun, a little bit about the solar system, and I was moving into the discussion of comets, the plasma discharge comet model, and the properties, and then comparing it to the standard snowball, or at the time they called it the ice ball comet model. But that's where we're at, so I'm going to jump right in and start that discussion and go through a whole litany of discoveries. And of course, the whole issue here is to give you a summary. Of course, every one of these topics could be blown into literally almost a semester-long college course, just to give you a feeling for the quantity of material here. But so what I'm doing is here is a basic topical summary of the discoveries, one by one, and then comparing them to standard science explanations. And so, at any rate, just I should mention also that eventually, when I was working with Russian scientists in the mid-90s, they devised a very simple, very effective experiment. And what they did, I explain this in my, I believe it's in the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. They took an X-ray detector and scanned in towards the sun, and I'm not going to go through that here, the details of the experiment, but they proved that the solar core is cooler than the atmosphere, proving my theory that the fusion is in the atmosphere of the sun, not at the core. And by the way, they also observed something that was explained by my theoretical work, and those were tornadoes on the sun. But all of this is to come later, because those were not observed until the 1990s by the Russians. Okay, so then off to the world of comets. The typical explanation of a comet is the standard is, I mean, it goes all the way back to Kepler, when they realized that the comets were not up in the atmosphere as Aristotle had been teaching, and Aristotle's teachings for thousands of years, that the comets were really out there and moving amongst the planets. Well, they said, well, the comets become more visible as they get closer to the sun, therefore they must be made up of ice that melts when it gets near the sun and causes this tail, which points away from the sun. In the 1600s explanation, that's not too bad. But in the year 2020, or the year 1979, when I was doing this work, it didn't cut the mustard at all. It didn't explain all kinds of properties that were well known, including sunward spikes. And that's one of the things that my model explicitly predicts is the sunward spike and X-rays to the sunward side of comets, which eventually was discovered in 1996, considered one of the top 10 scientific discoveries of 1996, was the discovery of X-rays to the sunward side of comets. And that I predicted in my papers in 1979 because of the electron beam coming out from the sun, and as it approached the comet nucleus, which had a cloud of electrons around it, the electron beam from the sun would slow down, causing Bremsstrahlung X-rays, breaking X-rays. And so, at any rate, the ice ball comet model came out of the 1950s as a response to Velikovsky. So it was literally the same year as Velikovsky's World in Collision hit the international press and went crazy, selling internationally. 1950, it's the same year that Fred Whipple was a young person, gained fame for basically taking the Keplerian idea from the Middle Ages and solidifying it in a published paper in a peer-reviewed journal. And so that's where that came from. Then it morphed over the years into the snowball comet model, then eventually the dirty snowball comet model, and then the eventually the much dirtier than dirty snowball comet model, where it's the ice is down in cracks and deposited somewhere down in the nucleus, because when they got to the nucleus of a comet nose to nose, there was no ice or snow or water. So they said, oh, it must be down in cracks. And so it just got to be absurd, piled on more absurdities. But anyway, the ice ball, or the dirty snowball comet model, as it is called today, is very simplistic. You have this thing that supposedly has ice and snow on it, and when the solar wind and the solar radiation hits it, it sublimates. In other words, it goes directly from the solid to the gas state, and it goes out and it forms a tail, and that's it. That's it. End of story. And it doesn't explain the size. It doesn't explain anything. So starting right away, I will go into the plasma discharge comet model, and you're going to see that it's an extremely complex interaction. And so when an object, it could have snow and ice on it, it will not for long. It'll get burned off very quickly, if it's especially a small comet, because of the intense radiation coming in on the electron beam. But it comes in to the solar capacitor, which I've already described. It breaks the gradient of the electric field, and so that's the initial discharge. It's similar to the backyard bug killer, where you have a outside screen that's grounded, and inside you have a light where the bugs are attracted to, and within the grounded screen there's another screen that's at a very high potential. And so it's just about at the breakdown point of error. And when the bug flies in, it brings in the ground potential with them and causes a discharge right where the bug is, always exactly where the bug is, and it discharges and kills the bug, and the bug falls down. But it's the same situation, except in the plasma environment of outer space, where the capacitor is not two metal grids or screens, but in fact plasmas. Clouds of charged gases and electrons. Okay, so at any rate, and the negatively charged sun is at the center, and the positively charged ion cloud is at the outside. And this is a very simplistic explanation of what is really going on. But as the comet moves in and begins discharging the solar capacitor, first, it's a local discharge, and then it grows and it grows, and it comes in closer to the sun, it grows more. So the visible size of the nucleus is one issue. How big is the nucleus? But the electromagnetic size of the object is very large. It can be millions of miles long, literally. And so then this discharge that's going on primarily will be electrons coming out from the sunward side. And what happens is, because this electron stream, it's like, say you threw a rock in a pool of water, and the water was coming down in a stream, what's going to happen is it's going to build up pressure on the upper side of the rock. And so that pressure is represents a density of water there. But in the comet case, you have an electron beam instead of water. So it builds up a pressure around the comet nucleus and a cloud of electrons. So it builds up a negative charge there. And so the ions, because this process is continuous and being powered from outside, the tail material, which is positively ionized material, dust and gases, etc., comes in, and that's what we see as the comet tail. So it's very complex, and then this discharge continues straight on a radial direction out beyond the comet nucleus and out into the reaches of the solar system. And the tail material is being drawn in to the comet. So this is the basic model, but then there's some other things that happen as a result of this. I already talked about the sunward spike, and what happens is when the electron beam on the sunward side interacts with gases in the coma, it lights it up like a light bulb, like a neon light bulb, and causes a visible sunward spike, and it's on the sunward side. And the scientific community has gone through contortions trying to explain this away, that, oh, it's a figment of your imagination. It's an optical illusion. It's really a type 2 tail pointing away from the sun, but it only looks like it's pointing towards the sun, etc. So they've gone through contortions trying to talk away the sunward spike. The cover of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, shows a squiggly, like a spiraling spike. And so that's indicative of a very large comet with magnetic fields. And so the electron beam then spirals in the electric field, causing the squiggly spike, etc. And the ancients have all kinds of analogies, like the horns of a bull, which is one of the effects of large comets, is that it develops horns. It looks like the horns of a bull. And so they actually call it that. Okay, in the ancient writings, because they didn't know what was going on. They were just describing what they saw up in the heavens. Okay, then what happens, because you have this negatively charged comet nucleus, and it's a space charge, it's this negative space charge that's around the comet nucleus, there's a thing then in plasma physics that's called Debye shielding. And so what happens is primarily hydrogen, but if you have carbon, if you have other carbon dioxide, you have other positively charged gases, primarily lightweight, very light gases, so it's primarily hydrogen, it forms a Debye shielding cloud in a big sphere that is centered around the nucleus of the comet. And so this is a shield, and it's visible. You can actually, it's one of the visible parts of a comet, especially if you're doing astrophotography where you're taking pictures of the comet. And so that's one of the features of this, and that's one of the observed features of comets, is this circular globular ball that is around the nucleus. And it can extend out to 100,000 miles from the nucleus. And so once again, the nucleus might be 10 or 20 miles across, or it could be planetary size, as in the case of Hale-Bopp, but then the electrical size is much, much bigger. And then in the tail region, you have, for example, there are pictures of Hale-Bopp that were taken by a professional astronomer using a Swan filter, a particular type of filter that looks at ionized hydrogen and oxygen. And so what you see is ionized water, doubly and triply ionized water. And so the tails on Hale-Bopp were like big snakes. We counted up to 17 of them at one time, and they were flailing around. And that's what the ancients saw also. When they talk about Venus, it had up to 13 different tails that are all flailing around as this huge comet came through the solar system. Okay, so what other properties? You have something called the pinch effect working. The pinch effect is a laboratory provable effect that when you have a plasma current flowing, that if the current gets larger and larger, the particles start to pull together because of the induced magnetic fields, and so it causes the electrical current to pull together. And if we, as later we get into the magnetic propulsion systems, this is one of the keys to the electric highways to the stars, understanding how these pinched currents that flow between the star systems, you're able to ride them, and it would be like the equivalent of if you had an old square-rigged sail ship and you were trying to cross the ocean. But instead of the wind just blowing and you're capturing the amount of wind that falls on the sail, what if the wind would concentrate on your sail? And that's what happens with the interplanetary, interstellar medium where you're traveling between stars with electromagnetic propulsion systems. And of course, that I also worked out in these years. I'll be getting to that a little bit later. But that means that comets, with its big electrical discharge, becomes a accelerating and a braking facility for spacecraft. And that's why if we ever come into another solar system or star system, we would typically look for a large comet in that solar system and then ride in on the discharge of of that star capacitor of this comet, and you could brake, you could slow down by catching the wave, so to speak, of that cometary discharge. Okay, so anyway, comets have all of these complex properties, including, as I said, X-rays to the sunward side of the nucleus. And that's out because, the electron beam coming into the front side of the nucleus starts to interact with the electrical charge it sees on the nucleus, and it starts to break, slow down. Electrons seeing other electrons is going to cause it to slow down, and so you get Bremsstrahlung or breaking X-rays. Okay, the other thing that is observable with a comet is the induced electric dipole redshift. So when you look at the light coming out of the region of the comet nucleus, it's redshifted. Now, this is one of the strangest properties of comets. And of course, when this was discovered experimentally, they threw away the data because they could not explain it. So a comet is a relatively complex electrical discharge plasma phenomena. And the reason it can keep going and keep charging is because it's discharging the solar capacitor, which is a huge energy source. It's a huge energy source that is available. For example, when Hale-Bopp, the big comet through the late 1990s, discovered when it went ballistic and went visible in 1995. It was July 15th, I believe, 1995. And over a period of 6 years, discharged the solar capacitor. So when it discharged the solar capacitor, the sun's energy went down, and the sun still has not recovered because it takes time to build up that amount of energy. So a planetary formation is much like, say, an animal in the forest or even a human being giving birth. It takes a lot of energy out of the system, and it takes a long time to recover. So this birthing process of planets, where large comets become planets, the small comets do not become planets because they don't have enough gravitational field to hold the material that's coming in. And so that's another property that's observed with comets, is that the neutrals are blowing out from the comet nucleus. So what's going on? The ionized material is coming in the tail towards the comet nucleus. As it gets near the nucleus, it then picks up an electron or two, becomes neutralized, and then flows out in the solar wind. And the spacecraft out there look at it that, and they go, oh, those are the neutrals coming from the ice ball. But no, that's not what's going on. Now, one of the most important parts of the cometary structure is the combination of the elements. So where do elements come from? Where do the complex organic molecules come from, all the way up to nucleotides? The building blocks of DNA are built in the tail of comets. And so where do those come from? How do they form? Well, you have the mixing of these clouds of atomic materials, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfurs, the potassiums, the sodium. All of these elements are free in the solar system, and when they come together, they combine. The potential curves of for the binding of these elements is overcome in this combination as they're brought together in the comet tail. So you have a very rich combination, a chemical soup, so to speak. And like I said, these molecules are forming all the way up to even DNA. And that's why in the comet tail of Venus, and by the way, all of the planets are discharging the solar capacitor, so they're all acting as comets. Earth has what they call a magnetic tail. It's really not a magnetic tail. It's due to the discharge of the solar capacitor. But the planets have a much lower discharge because they're in circular orbits. They're no longer cutting through the gradient of the electric field. And so anyway, one of the properties of comets is called tail drag. Well, I've already talked about this in dealing with the sun, and there's some more complex issues dealing with the orbital dynamics of stars as they come out from the galactic nucleus, a little bit too complicated to cover in this discussion. But in the discussion of comets, the larger comets have their orbits changed dramatically because of the tail drag. So all of this matter is being drawn in. The larger comets have enough gravitational pull to hold that matter, and it's a drag. And so this goes back to my discovery of a rare book when I was at Cornell. It was in the science stacks by TJJC on the capture mechanism for the development of solar systems, because they realized that the planets and moons of the solar system had indications in their orbits that indicated they were captured, not that they did not form all at one time. And so when you're talking about the formation of a solar system, there are so many things wrong with this Laplacian. I think I called it, some people call it Lagrangian, or the Laplacian formation of the solar system, where a single cloud rotates like a record disk and supposedly all the planets form. The only problem is clouds, dust clouds, without any type of central gravitational system or field, don't form. Planets don't form. Anyway, that's another discussion, a little bit too complicated for this show. But there are reasons why clouds of dust on their own do not form planets. There has to be some other mechanism that causes the density to increase and to draw these together, and that's the cometary process for the birthing of planets. But the tail drag is instrumental, because this is one of the things that the scientists did not understand when they went after Velikovsky. Remember that Velikovsky was talking about calendars. He was not a scientist. He was just observing what the ancients had said. He was literally reading ancient texts and translating them and then putting it out in his book, Worlds in Collision. And what they were saying is that the planet Venus formed from a large comet. Quetzalcoatl is the plumed serpent god of the night sky, was a large comet, the Venus comet in the Mayan legends. The same with Peru. The Incas had a legend exactly the same. The South American Native American Indians had the same legend with the phoenix, the rising of the phoenix. Okay, so all of these ancient cultures, the Chinese with the fire-breathing dragon, and talking about space effects, effects in outer space, etc., all of these referring to comets. But the tail drag, how does an object that's in an elliptical orbit move into a smaller circular orbit? And that's the tail drag. And this was so instrumental, once again, my being at Cornell, where probably that book, there's probably not more than a few copies of it in existence in the world. But of course, Cornell is a Library of Congress, so they had everything. They keep everything on purpose, even though they're old books and supposedly proven wrong. And so what TJJC, is spelled S-E-E is his last name, had propounded along with his partner, he had a co-author, was that there was a resisting medium in the solar system and that objects would eventually spiral inwards, and due to the drag of the so-called resisting medium, their orbits would become circularized and their energy levels would be reduced, so their orbits would get smaller and smaller with time. And of course, this was allegedly disproven, and because what they found out was, when they started really looking in outer space, there was not a lot of material out there. But the plasma discharge comet model solves that, because now the plasma discharge comet model is like a giant vacuum cleaner drawing this massive amount of material in from this huge volume of space. So you're concentrating all of this material in the solar system into the comet nucleus, and that drag is what causes the circularization of orbit and the reduction of the radius of the orbit. And so that's how a comet like Venus, which was captured by Jupiter, like, here's another mistake that Velikovsky made. It was a understandable mistake, was that that Venus was captured by Jupiter, and this capture process is part of the comet process also, because when the comets come into the solar system, then they can be captured by Jupiter or the Earth or one of the other planets in an energy exchange, and that reduces their orbit even further. So that's another property of comets, is their ability to become captured, and the larger comets eventually work in to become planets. And that makes sense because the ancients talk about Venus encountering Earth on two occasions. It encountered Mars on one major occasion. The two encounters with Earth, the first one was not too bad physically, but the second one devastated Earth, and that happened at the time that Moses was leading the Israelites out of Egypt. And so all of the things that were happening, the plagues, the fact that all of the insects came out of the ground, that's the electrification of the ground. When I was a little kid, we'd go out and take the car battery out of the car, and we'd take two wires and we'd stick them down into the ground. And the worms would come out of the ground. All of the bugs would come out of the ground, and we'd use them for fishing. Instead of digging a hole and trying to find worms, we'd go out in the evening, take the car battery, take two wires from each pole of the battery, stick it down into the ground, and those worms would just come up out of the ground like crazy. And we'd fill our can with dirt and worms and off to go fishing. That's what I did when we were little kids, to get worms and bugs, etc., to fish with. And but the same thing happened when the comet came by. It was electrifying the ground, and all of this vermin came out of the ground, and that's for the one of the plagues of that they talk about in Egypt. These are all effects of a passing large comet. Okay, and then the discharge, remember the big pillar of fire that extended into the sky, and it acted like a tornado? A very good depiction of that in the Yul Brynner as 1950s, the Ten Commandments movie. Very good depiction of the various effects of the comet passing by. And it stood in the way of them and Pharaoh's armies while they were able to pass through the Red Sea. And the reason the Red Sea was they could pass through is because the comet's gravitational waves was causing tidal waves in the Red Sea and pulling the water away, so they were able to pass through. And then when Pharaoh's armies came, and they were washed away by the returning tidal wave. And so anyway, all of these stories are recounted, and then Moses, by the way, National Geographic, found those chariots in the Red Sea. Those were discovered, and it's a true story. It's a true story. And then Moses with the Israelites wandered in the desert for 40 years, or a long time. Once again, that number 40, the ancient number for many. We don't know if it was 40 years or not, but it was just a long time. But they had the comet up in the sky that lit their way. It was like a big light in the sky. So at night, they were able to see without any lights or campfires, etc. And every morning, the manna would fall from the sky, another result of the comet. And that's one of the mysteries that really we haven't put a handle on yet, is what the manna was. But they were able to eat it. And remember that the comet tail was very rich in organic material. So they were actually able to eat this material that was falling into the atmosphere to sustain them during some of these periods out in the desert as they were walking around in the desert. In that same story, the Passover, where they went into hiding and they completely sealed their huts, including with mud over the door, and they planted with lamb's blood over the door. And the same event happened to the Mayans. Talk about it. There are Native American Indian tribes that talk about this and still honor this holiday and do the same ritual where they completely close up a hut. They took all of their food in there, and the blood over the door was to indicate that if you knock on the door, nobody's going to open it for you. And so they all were in hiding before this large comet came for the Passover. And of course, the pharaohs did not know about this. The Israelites did, because of their own history and knowledge of comets, and they survived. So anyway, a little bit of archaeological history along with this. So all of these properties of comets, now you can see that this is a much more complicated model of comet behavior than the dirty snowball comet model, which is just a snowball with the ice melting away. And so the characteristic shape of the comet nucleus is described in the mathematical equations that combine the electric fields of the comet nucleus with that of the sun. Those are published in my papers. And then you get to something that's very interesting when you start looking at the effects of electric fields. One of the things that Sagan criticized Relikovsky, he said, well, if there were charges in outer space, planets would go flying around and we don't see that. But what Sagan didn't know is that he was not a good physicist. He was not a student of gravity and electromagnetic systems. And I had all of these details worked out in my previous theoretical work. And what I realized is it was based on the charge to mass ratio. So that once you get up to something about the size of a golf ball, you get very little electrical effect because of this charge being a surface charge. And so if you look at the capability of something the size of a golf ball to maintain charge, its charge to mass ratio is very low. And so anything above a golf ball is certainly up to planet size are only going to be affected by gravitational fields. And so another property of comets is the understanding that electric fields are dominant for small particles, dust particles, ions, molecules, etc., in the region of the comet. But, and that's another aspect of the discharge itself, of the plasma discharge, is that the majority charge carrier is in form of electrons. The vast majority of the electrical discharge is electrons because of their charge to mass ratio being much higher than that of anything else, 2,000 times more than even a proton, millions of times more than an ion. And that's why the charge on the nucleus is negative. So anyway, I'm discovering all of these facts. Now, once again, compare that to the dirty snowball comet model. There's no comparison. The real cometary situation explains what you see. It also explains, for example, why there is a hydrogen spherical cloud around the comet nucleus. And what you're seeing there are the actual lines, the spectral lines of hydrogen and carbon. You can see those in that cloud. That is a Debye shielding cloud. And the dirty snowball comet model, there's no reason to have this big globular cloud around it. The other thing explained by the plasma discharge comet model is that the coma of the comet shrinks. It gets smaller as you approach the sun because of the way the electric fields work. So all of these properties of comets are explained by the plasma discharge comet model. And compare this, these two models, it just, there's no comparison. And now remember, this is 1979. Nobody had a clue of the real nature of comets. Some people had, going back to the 1800s, people had noticed electrical phenomenon related to comets just by observing them. But nobody had an idea of what was really going on. Not the least of which was to create an entire theoretical model. And, of course, none of the other parts of this existed. The understanding of the solar wind, the differential current flow of protons in the solar wind and how it created the capacitor and how the capacitor discharged and how the comet would then build up matter, the big ones, and change their orbits and could become planets, explaining how the planet Venus got to where it is today. And that was one of the big problems, too, with standard science, as they said, well, that's impossible. You couldn't get something in this elliptical orbit down to where Venus is, between us and the sun. Well, the ancients are very explicit that Earth had two encounters with Venus, and the Mayans very much honored this even until the very last writings that they had, the Popol Vuh, etc., which was some of their sacred books that are passed down to us, talk specifically about the 52-year cycle. Other civilizations talk about that also because of the second encounter of Venus with planet Earth. Okay, And so I'm not going to go into the politics of all of this, but it was just suffice it to say, when this was released in 1979, nobody had a clue of what I was talking about, let alone could they replace their sacred little snowball model or ice ball comet model. Okay, so I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to try and concentrate on just the theoretical aspect of this. So now we get to the one last thing about the comet model is there was an effect that was noticed, and it was basically published by a guy named Oort. And I will call it the Oort effect, because what science did was they interpreted this. Because when comets come into the solar system, you can determine their orbit. And then what you do is you go out and you determine how far away they are from the sun when they started this orbit that they're on. And what this guy Oort came up with after examining enough comet orbits is there's kind of a region very far, in fact, light years away from the sun, you know, hundreds if not thousands of times the distance of Pluto from the sun, where this alleged Oort cloud would be, where these ice balls formed, and then every now and then something, maybe a passing star, influences them and they come into the solar system. And so the effect was that the outer boundary of their elliptical orbit was in this kind of region way out away from the sun. Okay, and so anyway, the plasma discharge comet model explains this. Because when the comets are working their way into the solar system, they're going to lose a little bit of energy. And so what happens is that even though they're coming in from an infinite distance, in other words, out of the gravitational influence of the sun, what happens is they lose a little bit of energy, so that it makes it look, by the time they get into the inner solar system where you start measuring their orbits, they've already lost some energy. And so it looks like their orbit started in this Oort region, and thus the Oort cloud. So I call it the Oort effect. And what's really going on is a natural process of comets that they are losing a little bit of their energy, and it only makes it appear like they're coming from this certain region a great distance away from the sun. So very important. All of these, I'll remember too, I taught astronomy at the university level for a number of years. And in my teaching career, I taught physics, mathematics, computer science, and astronomy over a period of about 10 years in my teaching career. And then I spent another 25 years in the telecommunications industry as a systems engineer and a design engineer, hardware and software. I was not a programmer. I was a designer and then a network engineer, where we managed large networks, and I did that for about 15 years, but requiring my knowledge of a very detailed knowledge of computer networks and networking and protocols, communication protocols, and everything that goes with it. In my teaching years, about 10 years of my career at the university level, I did teach astronomy. So here I am teaching the students astronomy out of a standard astronomy textbook, and knowing full well that all of this is garbage. In fact, I'm going to just do a little aside note here. I had a student come up to me, and she had taken astronomy also at one of the major universities, and was taking this as an elective in her program, you know, because there's a lot of electives you take when you're getting your degree. And she said, you know, I didn't know astronomy was fun and interesting. She said, I hated it when I took it at the university. She said it was dry, it was boring, it was a bunch of details that I didn't care about. I never knew astronomy was interesting. That's what a student told me. Okay, now we're going to talk about planets. Now, the planets will be everything that you typically call a planet except Jupiter and Saturn, because I consider those small stars, Jupiter being the other star of our twin star system, basically. And so regarding the planets, all of them, all of the planets, all of the moons were adapted, they were captured into the solar system at a later date. And if you look at any of the properties of the solar system, if the planets had been here for 4.5 billion years, they would all lay perfectly in the same plane as the second star, Jupiter, because of its gravitational effect. If something is above the plane of Jupiter's orbit, it pulls down on it. If the object is below the plane of Jupiter's orbit, it pulls up on it until they would lie in the same plane. And you get this effect very much, for example, the rings of Saturn or the zodiacal disk of the Sun, which is pulled because of the bulge in Saturn and the bulge at the equator of the Sun. And so you can tell that for example, Mercury either had its orbit influenced greatly in recent times, recent meaning astronomical recent, not last year, but maybe millions of years ago, but its orbit is not the original orbit, or it's a new planet, one of the two. Because if it had been there for 4.5 billion years, its orbit would be a circle, and it would be in line with the orbital plane of Jupiter. And same with Earth. Our orbit is tilted with respect to Jupiter. Same with Mars. Same with Venus. And same with the outer planets, and especially Pluto. All of these are indications that the solar system has undergone changes recently. If you look at the planet Mars, clearly its surface features, I have a whole page on my Picture of the Day subpage, which is linked from all of my show archives. Everyone has a link that goes to the Picture of the Day subpage. But I have a whole section on Mars showing the pristine riverbeds and water geological features on Mars that would not last more than a few thousand years given the big dust storms that are constantly occurring on Mars. And so Mars had an atmosphere and oceans in recent times, certainly within the past 10,000 years and more than likely within the last couple thousand years. And we know this also because the ancients talk about Mars being a blue planet, a water planet. And so, and there's some other very interesting stories mixed with that, that in the ancient texts, they talk about the people, Baal, who lived on Mars and came to Earth. These are what the ancient texts talk about it. In fact, remember the Flash Gordon series, the 1930s or 20s, whenever Flash Gordon was in early stages of movies, and it had come out as a comic book. The story was about Ming the Merciless living on Mars and sending death rays to Earth and things like that. This all came out of ancient tales. They were just adapting this to a modern script for modern consumption. And then the Flash Gordon little spaceship. And isn't it funny that today the spaceships, instead of the big tall Saturn V rocket, are morphing into the Flash Gordon spaceship, the little tube spaceship that flies up and comes landing with the tail burning and landing with a soft landing. We're back to that. That was in the 1920s. Very interesting. Anyway, that's a little bit of a side note. But the planets and the moons, our moon is 6.5 degrees off, of the plane of Earth's orbit. And so anyway, it had some kind of a major disruption. Certainly was not the orbit that would have been there for 4.5 billion years if the solar system formed from this amazing dust cloud. That would have pulled itself into a plane, and all of the planets and moons would be perfectly in a single plane. So that's one of the big immediate observations, that this dust cloud spinning like a record disc forming the planets doesn't work. Also, all the planets spin in the forward direction. In other words, if you're looking from the north side of the solar system, looking down, the Earth spins in a counterclockwise direction. So does Venus a little bit. Venus doesn't spin too much. But all of the other planets spin in that same direction. And if you had a collapsing dust cloud, they would all spin in the opposite direction. So you know what the explanation is? That, oh, an asteroid hit it and caused it just to turn in the other direction. So all of the planets needed this special asteroid to come in and hit it to make it move in the right direction. Absolutely absurd. Statistically impossible. Even NASA admits that 27 of Saturn's moons are captured because they're in retrograde orbits. They're in orbits that are out of the plane of the ring system of Saturn. They're just very clearly 27 of the moons of Saturn are captured. But then they insist that all the other ones are from the original source of the collapsing cloud 4.5 billion years ago. So without saying too much, when I wrote my book, the title of my book that I wrote, 300 pages in Cornell, Origin of the Planets, Comet Capture Processes and the Formation of Solar Systems. And so it went through this, everything I'm telling you, outlined it, and then, of course, went into greater detail. And that was the basis for the three-part comet paper that was published after I left Cornell. But this, all this work was done at this time. Now compare this to the extremely simplistic models that are offered by standard science, that the solar system formed from this collapsing dust cloud. Extremely simplified, it doesn't explain what we see. That comets are dirty snowballs. Very simplistic, does not explain what we see. That the universe began in a big bang and is expanding. It doesn't explain what we see. And that outer space is electrically neutral, and it doesn't explain what we see. But of course, they, in their haste to judgment, didn't do a good analysis of the real properties of electromagnetism in outer space. Little things like the charge to mass ratio, or the understanding that only the smallest objects are affected by electrical conditions and magnetic conditions in the solar system. And so you have to analyze it from that point of view, not the point of view, the really simplistic and incorrect point of view, that planets would be charged and they would go flying around the solar system. And that's simply not true, because any true analysis would understand that. And then the idea that they are sending spacecraft out that are very poorly designed, that they are making measurements and they don't know what they mean. They're trying to make measurements of the count of particles in the solar wind with a single spacecraft, and the end result is that you can't do it. You can't measure voltages, potential differences, with a single spacecraft. It's impossible. And so they're doing all of this science, which is bogus. It doesn't make any sense. The satellites are poorly designed for their mission. They don't have any ability to detect true magnetic fields. They're measuring spurious magnetic fields. They don't understand spacecraft charging. And, just on and on. It's just bizarre. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about Jupiter and Saturn being small stars. And this came out also while I was at Cornell. The Voyager and Pioneer spacecraft measured properties at Jupiter and Saturn, indicating that they are small stars. The proton wind coming up off the surface was a direct measurement. The ring systems, the fading of the ring systems, my prediction of the moons in the Saturnian ring system and Jupiter's ring system that caused the fadings of the ring, the fact that the moons that were charged and discharging the local capacitors of Jupiter and Saturn were also driving their magnetic fields. And going back to Earth, I developed the five-layer magnetic field of Earth, where the smallest component was the geological magnetic field of iron and nickel, primarily in the Earth's mantle, which gave this northerly direction magnetic field. But the bulk of the magnetic field of Earth is in the plasma. It's in the jet streams. It's in the counter-rotating ionic, the ionosphere current sheets. There are five of them on Earth. There's the western moving electron sheet around the equator. Then there's the temperate climate current sheets that are positive that are moving easterly direction, and then at the poles you have two more electron belts that are moving in the westerly direction, and also explaining the cross currents, the cross polar currents, eventually I'll get into my weather work, so that when there's a solar storm and the solar wind comes in, the protons go in one direction and the electrons go in the other direction when they meet the Earth's magnetic field. This is the plasma magnetic field, including the Van Allen belts and the plasma magnetic field that's about 30,000 miles out from Earth. The solar wind splits, and when you have a big solar storm with a rush of protons, it collapses the magnetic field of Earth, and that compression kicks off storm systems. And this can happen also when the Earth aligns with other planets and other comets. And so this led to my weather work, where I was able to predict months in advance severe weather on Earth because of cometary and other electrical alignments. So all of this coming together, and you can see all of these same electrical effects around Jupiter. The Great Red Spot of Jupiter is nothing more than a big hurricane that's been going and going and going since Galileo first saw it. And Jupiter has 13 counter-rotating bands, and they're symmetrical. The northern hemisphere is symmetrical with the southern hemisphere. And the reason hurricanes stop on Earth is because they literally short out electrically when they make landfall. Okay, so look at the number of discoveries then that hurricanes and weather, this is going back to the Great Red Spot of Jupiter, are driven by electric fields from the vertical electric field of the planet from the ionosphere down to the surface of the planet. And so that's what's driving these cyclonic storms, including tornadoes, hurricanes, cyclones, waterspouts, etc. So once again, and then this led, like I said, in the 1980s with the Russians looking at tornadoes on the sun. Okay, so I'm going to have to pick up my pace here because I only have a few minutes left in this show in the end of this month on the Cornell years. Okay, so this then explains the induced electric dipole redshift. I'll just mention that it is the cause of bending of light and the redshift when light leaves a fusion-based object or a charged object like the comet nucleus from the non-uniform electric field. Okay, and so the explanation of archaeology, mountain building, I overturned the concept of plate tectonics, which was the uniformitarian, very slow movement of tectonic plates. I showed that doesn't make sense, and that the real cause of mountain building was because of the gravitational wave of large passing comets, that the water on Mars was a historical event, the removal of the water on Mars, and other archaeological events including the pole shifts, etc., that are related to passing comets, and then the term action at a distance, that all of these influences on Earth and the other planets happen at a distance. They don't have to collide. And of course, that overturns the NASA standard explanation for everything that they see, that an asteroid hit it. Okay, so the magnetic propulsion systems was an invention because I understood the electrical currents in outer space between star systems, the electrical current that's flowing down the arm systems of the galaxy, which produce the electric highways to the stars, and the pinch effect, which concentrates those currents on spacecraft, which is an effect that is it's imperative to understand this for interstellar travel using magnetic propulsion systems. I invented two magnetic propulsion systems, and as I said, you wouldn't invent these if you didn't think that there were if you thought there was no electrical currents in outer space, you would never try to invent a magnetic propulsion system or electromagnetic propulsion system. And so in the coming April, I'll be talking about these, because after I left Cornell, this is what I went to Los Angeles after my respite period of up in the wilderness of Canada for about 10 months. I was out in Los Angeles selling my magnetic propulsion systems. And of course, I was greeted as a tier one scientist because everybody knew me. the work of Tesla. I took the work of Tesla and advanced it to the point where we understood where those electric fields came from. And it was due to the Earth's discharge of the solar capacitor and how these seven layers, or the five layers of the magnetic field, etc., influenced the current sheets that also drove the hurricanes down at the troposphere, etc. But I took the work of Tesla and understood what he was doing with his Wardenclyffe Tower. And, of course, the standard story was that the science tried to pawn off on people is that he was trying to transmit power with his Wardenclyffe Tower. Well, he had sold all his technology to Westinghouse, and so he had no source for his power. And what he was doing is he was gathering it from the ionosphere, and he was actually shipping the electricity underground because he understood the resonant frequency of currents in the ground, and he was using those. Okay, so the other thing was Einstein's work on the unification of the fields. I extended that to the point because I understood the pair production in photons. This is going back to the induced electric dipole redshift. So you can see that all of these discoveries, including the high temperature, the cause of the high temperature of a planet like Venus because it was a new planet, the explanation of medical conditions, for example, the tail of Venus, which Earth passes through during the inferior conjunction of Venus, why does that cause flu on Earth because the virus is in the tail? And why is there an increase in sunspot activity when we have the inferior conjunction with Venus, plus planetary alignments, and eventually plus the verification of astrology based on the birth date of the child because they're influenced by the electric fields of the planets that are in position at that time. So all of these discoveries came out of what I did. But all of these things that I've been telling you were during the Cornell years. And that's the main point here, that I wanted to summarize these discoveries. And literally, if you go through this again and you listen to this program again in the last number, of March 2022, the five programs, you'll discover that there are dozens and dozens of major discoveries, any one of which would be Nobel Prize category work. And so it's very important to understand that also the huge negative impact of standard science in their complete ignorance of what's going on in the world, in the universe, in the solar system, etc. So next week I'll be talking about the time after I left Cornell, etc., what was going on those last few weeks that I was at Cornell, and then move on into the future. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.